It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, after 171 years of statehood, 40 previous male chief executives dating way back to 1846, Iowa now has its first female governor in Ken Reynolds. This hour, we want to talk a little bit about the history made here yesterday in Iowa and the historic context of this milestone, and see how Governor Reynolds fits into the context of five other current female governors in the country. Let's talk about it with Debbie Walsh, director for the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Also with us, Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. Diane, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben.
Let's just have you each reflect generally on the history made here in Iowa this week, yesterday with the inauguration of Kim Reynolds. Diane, please go ahead.
Well, I think I'll start a little bit from the Iowa perspective, and I know that Debbie has a lot of national media's national information. But, you know, for Iowa, obviously, we've lagged behind the rest of the nation in the election of women to not only the state legislature, but also U.S. Congress and now governor. And so, you know, we've made some strides over the last couple of years. In 2014, Joni Ernst became the first woman from Iowa elected to the U.S. Congress, getting us off that list of states never had sent a woman to Congress. And then now with the succession of Kim Reynolds to be governor of Iowa, we're one of only currently now four states that have both a woman governor and a woman in Congress.
Debbie Walsh, add to that with your thoughts.
Well, we've been waiting a long time for this moment for Iowa, because it always struck us as odd to see Iowa in the mix of states that had never elected a woman for quite some time, either to Congress or to the governor's seat. And really at the end there, until Joni Ernst was elected, it was just Iowa and Mississippi, which never fit for me, for my sense of Iowa and women's participation in politics there. So I think it is a moment to celebrate and to see this as a moment of a change in course. I hope that will lead to more women, certainly more women in Congress and more women in statewide elected office there.
What caused this? Is there a reason that now, 2014, with the election of Joni Ernst and now with Kim Reynolds being inaugurated as governor after over 170 years of statehood, Diane, is there something happening under it, underneath the surface, so to speak?
What happened with both Senator Ernst and Governor Reynolds is opportunity, and that's what women need to look for. In 2014, it was an open seat race to succeed Tom Harkin in the U.S. Senate. Joni Ernst took advantage of that open seat race, like not only we, but also I know the center at Rutgers encourages women not only to run, but to look at open seat races where they have more than a 50% chance of winning. And so there was an opportunity. Joni Ernst seized it. She ran a very good primary campaign with, I think, excellent communication. I liked her ads, even though they got some national notoriety. But she also, I think, stayed on message during the debates, and so she was able to not only win a contested Republican primary, but also win an election in what would be a change year. You know, whenever a Democratic president is in office, typically Republicans do well in those midterm elections, and so she capitalized on that as well. Certainly with Kim Reynolds, it's an opportunity of her lifetime to have the governor be named ambassador to China, and again, she was in the right spot at the right time. I will note that there has been a woman lieutenant governor in Iowa consecutively since 1987. And so Iowa has done a good job with women lieutenant governors. And in this case, with the governor leaving, Kim was able to step up and be governor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the things that we've been talking about when people ask us about this moment in Iowa with a woman governor and why hasn't there been one earlier. And part of it is exactly what Diane's talking about, is opportunity. I mean, you do have in Terry Branstad the longest serving governor in American history, which makes it very tough for an outsider to break in. And so it really is a moment of opportunity. And as Diane says, you've had a lot of women lieutenant governors, but she was the one who was there at the moment when the governor stepped down. And I think it's interesting to note that of the six women who are currently now serving as governor, three of them got there because the governor stepped down and they were next in line in succession. Kate Brown in Oregon because of scandal, who was Secretary of State, who stepped in there. Kay Ivey, who was the lieutenant governor in Alabama most recently, when her governor had to step down in scandal. And now Kim Reynolds stepping in because the governor was appointed to be ambassador.
Mm-hmm. Debbie, what does that tell you? That that doesn't reflect well, does it, on the looking past gender to the qualities of the candidate, does it, when you name that?
No, I think what it means is that it's important to have women in all of these other statewide elected positions as well as governor so that they are positioned when there are moments of opportunity. One of the things that we know when we think about that year 1992, which is always talked about as the year of the woman when we doubled the number of women in Congress, it wasn't just happenstance. It was because there were a lot of women who were positioned in other offices who could take advantage of opportunities of open seats, and they took advantage of that. And I think that's always important. We need to see women running for governor, and that is significant and important, and perhaps we'll see that in 2018 when quite a few gubernatorial seats are up. But we also need to make sure that we have women who are positioned and ready to take advantage of opportunities.
In Iowa's case, we now have a female senator since 2014 and since yesterday, a female governor for the first time in our state's history. But I wonder the larger question when you look at the whole country, Diane, let me toss it to you first. They're both Republicans in Iowa's case, I wanted to say. Does one major party do a better job when we look nationally at putting female nominees on the ballot and getting them elected?
Well, really, in recent history, the Democratic Party has done a much better job when it comes to electing women, especially to legislative office. If you look at the statistics that are on the Center for American Women in Politics website at Rutgers, and they have an excellent website with all sorts of information, you're welcome, Debbie. You'll see, I've been using it since the 1990s, but what you'll see on that website is that women in legislative office, both at the state legislative level and also in Congress, if you look at the women in there, somewhat up to 2/3 to 3/4 of the women in those offices are Democrats. And so certainly at the legislative level, you'll see that. Now, for executive level, Republicans have done a bit better with statewide executive offices. You know, of those 20 or 39 women who have served as governor, about, I think it was 22 are Democrats and 17 are Republicans. And when you look at recent history, it tilts a little bit more in favor of Republicans. Currently, of the 6 women serving now, 2 are Democrats and 4 are Republicans. So women, Republican women are tending to do a little bit better when it comes to running for executive offices like governor or state elected than they are for state legislature or U.S. Congress.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned 2018, Debbie. Tell us a little bit more about the next election coming up next year. A chance we'll see more women running for executive office or for lawmakers?
I think we'll be seeing more women running across the board, or at least early indications are that. There are 38, as I said before, there are 38 gubernatorial seats up in 2018. So lots of opportunity, and we'll see, we've already started to see a flurry of activity. For instance, in Ohio, there are 3 women who are very serious candidates talking about running for governor there. So I think we're going to see that across the country. We've been watching what we have on our website is called The Buzz. So women being talked about and women who are already thinking about running. We're seeing quite a few women there, but the early indication is really looking at the 2 states with state legislative races, Virginia and right here in New Jersey. And we're seeing a big increase in the state of Virginia. I think a lot of that increase in interest is coming from Democratic women who are, I think, for a lot of them for the very first time, really thinking about running for office in the wake of the 2016 election. And I think we're seeing that across the country. I know we do our Ready to Run program here in New Jersey. Diane runs the Iowa version of Ready to Run at Iowa State at the CATS Center. And I think they've also seen a big increase in the interest that women have right now in learning how they can be more engaged in politics. And we're really looking to see in 2018 how that translates for women candidates, both at the congressional level, but also at the state legislative level and the municipal level across the country.
Diane, on the ground there at ISU, tell us a little bit more what it does look like with the Ready to Run program. Tell us quickly what it's about, what it does. It's nonpartisan.
That's right. And we have the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers started the program, I believe, in 1998 and then took on national partners in 2007. And we were one of the first, I think, four national partners in 2007. The CAT Center runs Ready to Run every other year in odd number years. And this year we saw a record enrollment, as did the program in New Jersey and programs all over the United States in Ready to Run. We changed from a one-day format that we had to a series of six workshops that you can take one or six. We started that in 2013. And so our largest individual enrollment prior to this year was 71 unique individuals going to at least one workshop. This year we had 172 unique individuals. And if you looked at the enrollment, the total enrollment, it was 499 in all six sessions. So we had to move our sessions off campus because we only had a room that seated 60. I think, like Debbie, we started getting emails the day after the election with
Absolutely.
People just asking us, when are you having your next Ready to Run? And we were not planning to advertise our Ready to Run until the Tuesday after the election. By Sunday night, I think I had 49 or 50 emails unsolicited to the CAT Center's just general website, email address saying, when are you offering Ready to Run? So everybody in the Ready to Run network, I just saw an email today, Debbie, you probably saw too, that there's a program, I can't remember what state it is, but they're already, I think their program's in September, and they're already seeing a record enrollment, one of our other partners. And so it's in. So it's just blossoming, and we had people, I think we did a survey after our first workshop, and 86% of the respondents said that they were planning to run for elected office in 2017, 2018, or 2020, and so that's an extremely high amount for our first workshop. We saw women there running for school board. I mean, I think that's the other thing, and Debbie can talk to it too, is that people aren't waiting until 2018. We had a lot of people in Ready to Run that had already looked at running for city council, school board, and mayor in 2017.
Absolutely. I think what we're seeing around the country is that women are really taking to heart that old adage in politics, which is that if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And the women are really concerned that in this new administration, they may well be on the menu, and that they want to make sure they have a voice, and they're running for everything. They're running for school board, local council, county government. They are not waiting for the big elections anymore. They're going to run for everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, the term that you use in this field of study, one term is multiplier effect. Talk a little bit about that. That has to do with the fact that women get elected, and that sort of ripples out like a stone in a pond to cause more women to enter politics?
Well, that's actually dissertation research that came out of one of Debbie's colleagues now at Rutgers University on the multiplier effect. And what she found in her dissertation research is that she coded states by no effect, one effect, and it was one effect, two effect, three effects. And so three effect states, for example, would be New Hampshire, a state that has had multiple women not only at the gubernatorial level but in the U.S. Congress. And so what Shauna found is that the more of a multiplier effect, and it was particularly strong for having a woman elected governor and elected to the U.S. Senate. And so she found that that had a trickle-down effect, along with some other factors, in electing more women at the state legislature. And I'm sure Debbie knows probably even more about her study than I do, although because she's on their political science faculty.
No, I think that's actually a really good description of it. But I think what's interesting is, I think when you think about the Hillary Clinton multiplier effect, we were a little concerned the day after the election that the defeat of Hillary Clinton might discourage a lot of women, and that they would be so turned off by the tenor and the tone of the campaign, and they would see a very, you know, qualified and by any definition woman candidate losing, that they might really turn away from politics and check out. And in fact, we have seen quite the opposite, that she's had a multiplier effect, but it's been even in the defeat of a woman candidate.
Well, what do you believe is behind that, Debbie?
Well, I think that there is that old adage that that Marianne Wright Edelman talks about, which is you can't see, be what you can't see, that when women start to see women taking on high-level leadership positions and being successful and accomplishing things, it gives them the sense that this is something they could do. It is part of why we also run a program called New Leadership, National Education for Women's Leadership, which is a program for college women to demystify the political process. We actually have a partnership at the University of Iowa for that program, and it really is an opportunity for young women to see and meet and talk to and learn from women who are in politics, because just by meeting someone who does this job, it opens up a world of opportunities for them. So I think it can't be underestimated what it means for women to see other women doing this and being successful and being inspirational.
Debbie Walsh is with us this half hour, along with Diane Bystrom. Diane of Iowa State University, where she's director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics. Debbie Walsh, director for the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Let's talk about a couple of other related topics here. Back to what we often talk about in this context. How do we tend to think about female candidates differently? Do we use a different yardstick in some cases to measure those running for office based on their gender, Debbie?
Well, there's been all kinds of fascinating research looking at some of the different challenges that women who run for office face. For instance, we know that women who run for office have to kind of prove their qualifications. Male candidates tend to be seen, there's sort of an assumption of qualifications, whereas women have to prove their qualifications, which kind of puts them in a double bind, because when you have a candidate, for instance, like Hillary Clinton, who talks about policy and in a way as a, you know, showing her qualifications, then people talk about her as, well, she's such a policy wonk and she never, you know, she's not talking to me, she's talking about policy, but yet you have to do that. There's also a likability factor. Women have to not just be qualified, they also have to be likable. And sometimes when you're trying to prove you're qualified, it might be undercutting, in fact, that kind of folksy charm that people look for and when they think about a likable candidate. So there are these double binds that women who are running for office confront, and double standards that they confront. I also still think, I think things have gotten better in sort of mainstream media, but I do think that there are still double standards about the way in which women are talked about and reported on. They are talked about more on their appearance, on their voices, on the way they present themselves. We certainly saw that in the last presidential campaign when Hillary Clinton, people would tweet about her and talk about her in the media. She doesn't smile enough and she's always yelling at me. No one ever was worried that Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, for that matter, you know, are not big grinners and certainly do a lot of yelling themselves. But when a woman is presenting in that way, it gets called out. All of these things really are a challenge for women who are running for office.
Right. And going back to the last election, a male candidate just has to put on a suit and a tie, make sure that that lapel pin of the U.S. flag is on there as well. Then you're done, right? It's got to be
fewer choices, fewer options.
How much time was spent talking about Hillary Clinton's pantsuits, for instance?
Yeah.
And she had to have a new one on every big outing, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And lots of comments about the wardrobe.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, are there other countries we can look to where men and women are roughly equal, better than here in the U.S. when we talk about the numbers of elected officials?
Well, currently the U.S. ranks about 100th in the world for the percentage of women in our national legislature. So there are lots of countries doing better. The top country in the world is Rwanda for the percentage of women serving in their national legislature. Diane, you can talk about this as well.
Well, I think there's, yes, Rwanda's number one. I think, you know, we keep on going down. We might even be 109th now. So we, as
we're in the bottom half, though, to be sure.
I don't know where we're not doing very well. You know, Rwanda has been number one for years. People always seem to be surprised about that when I give presentations. The countries that also do traditionally well are the Scandinavian countries. In fact, we have a study abroad right now in Sweden that is funded by donors interested in sending our Iowa State students to countries where women have more of a role in government and business. And so we have gone to Sweden. This is our third year. We're actually going to Nicaragua in a year, which actually ranks also in the top 10. So there's Latin American countries, South American countries, and the Scandinavian countries usually do pretty well. But many of those countries have different systems of government than we do, and elect more either with a quota or elect on a party system that seems to not only engage more women in the process, but younger people.
Mm-hmm. If more women were elected in the United States, can anything be said about how our politics would change generally, very generally speaking, if at all? I'm just going to jump here and say perhaps more civil, less macho, less competitive, more cooperative. Anything ringing true there?
Well, we've done some research looking at men and women serving in state legislatures, and in general, we know that women who serve in legislatures across the country are more likely to have as priorities issues affecting women, families, and children. So we know that some of the policy agenda might change, but also the process, in that we've also found that women are more likely to believe that government should operate more transparently and out in the open. And we've also found, particularly in some new research that we're going to be releasing shortly on women in Congress, that they seem to have much more of a sense of working across party lines, and that ability to at least build relationships across party lines. And I think in large part it's because there's a different reason that women have for being in office. Men are more likely to tell us that the reason they ran for office in the first place was a interest in a career in politics. And the women are more likely to tell us that the reason they first ran for office was because of a policy issue. They wanted to get something done. And if you want to get something done in government, you're going to have to figure out ways to work together. And that's going to involve compromise, and it's going to involve talking to people across the aisle. So we see that more with the women, and I think that is something that would change if we had more women. And I know that the Democratic women in Congress tell us that they wish there were more Republican women in Congress that they could work with, because there are just so few of them. Republican women make up only about 9% of the Republican caucus, whereas Democratic women make up almost a third.
Diane, a quick word from you. Only 20 seconds left. Where should we be in 5 or 10 years? What's our goal?
Well, I'm hoping that we get off. We're now 30th in the country in the composition of our state legislature when it comes to women. I'm hoping that we can move that up. Since I've been here in 1996, we've never been at even the 25th percentile. So I think one of the things I'm hoping, not only with the election of Joni Ernst, but also Kim Reynolds, is that we move those numbers up in our state legislature.
Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.